From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. There's a tiny island off Puerto Rico called Cayo Santiago. For the past 80 years, it's been home to hundreds of rhesus macaques and to a long and important science project with researchers observing, tagging, and testing the monkeys to learn about them and, by extension, sometimes about us. When Hurricane Maria hit in 2017, the island was stripped clean as the monkeys clung together on whatever high ground they could find. And ever since, scientists have been studying the monkeys for signs of lasting trauma or a new resilience. This hour on Point, the monkeys of Cayo Santiago and the emotional aftershocks of disasters on us and our primate cousins. And you can join us. Have you experienced a devastating natural disaster or war or famine? And what were the lasting traumatic psychological aftershocks? Did it change your family? Did it change your neighborhood? Did it change the society you live in? Join us anytime on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us first today is Luke Dietrich. He's a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine, and his latest piece for the magazine is called Primal Fear: Can Monkeys Help Unlock the Secrets of Trauma? We have a link to it at onpointradio.org, and Luke joins us today from Halifax, Nova Scotia. Luke Dietrich, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, I would love it if you could sort of give us a more of a mental image of Cayo Santiago before Hurricane Maria hit. What was it like? It's a tiny little island off the coast of Puerto Rico.
Sure. Well, I only personally experienced it a couple weeks after the hurricane hit was when I first experienced it. But I can sort of paint a picture of what it looked like before. It has, for the last 80 years, been a remarkable, unique research site. A guy named Clarence Carpenter from Columbia University had this idea that, you know, back in 1938, that with the war looming, people stateside were going to need a sort of steady supply of research monkeys. So he mounted an expedition to India and came back with about 500 rhesus macaques, which he released on this little island off the southeast coast of Puerto Rico, Cayo Santiago, which at the time had been sort of used by a sort of cane baron to graze goats. And so they removed the goats and put the monkeys on. And from the beginning, it was viewed as sort of this it was both kind of a monkey farm in the sense that they were planning to sell the monkeys that were breeding there, but they also saw it as this opportunity to view monkeys in a kind of semi-wild environment. Carpenter viewed it as being in this sort of Goldilocks zone of being not too wild, not too tame. They were sort of habituated to human presence after a while, and it was a small enough place that you could go and sort of observe them freely and always know that you were going to encounter plenty of monkeys, which is very different from field work in, you know, a remote jungle somewhere where you may not encounter any monkeys at all for days at a time. But it was also sort of wild enough, and they were kind of untethered enough that they would behave in natural ways. So it right from the beginning was this sort of unique place. And then it only became more important as the years passed. Successor to Carpenter, a guy named Stuart Altman, in the 1950s, began really drilling down on kind of this sort of regimented data collection processes that became sort of instituted there, where they would make sure to tag all the monkeys, to take sort of daily censuses of their behavior whenever possible, and to keep this sort of daily diary of kind of observational data and sort of genealogical data going forward. And that created, as the sort of the decades went by, it created a sort of unprecedented community in terms of the amount of longitudinal data we have on this one primate colony. It's arguable that there isn't even a human population that has so much sort of intimate longitudinal data,
yeah.
Piled up about it. And that allows scientists to, you know, do all sorts of work. You know, when they're studying a particular macaque on Cayo Santiago, that macaque is really the sort of tip of the iceberg of data that's lying underneath, stretching back multiple generations of ancestors for each monkey.
So it's a very rare environment then to try and ask all sorts of questions about, as you said, not just the individual animals, but about sort of how they behave in groups. So what did you see when you went to visit Cayo Santiago after Hurricane Maria really smashed the island?
Sure. So my first visit there was in sort of early-ish October after the hurricane, a couple weeks after the hurricane. And at that point, the researchers and the Caribbean Primate Research Center, which is the sort of institute that oversees the island and helps kind of keep the monkeys alive, they were in full-on sort of survival mode, delivering food whenever possible, water whenever possible, sort of trying to keep the monkeys alive. The hurricane, as it did to the rest of Puerto Rico, really devastated the island, knocked down, you know, high 80% of all the trees, most of the vegetation, pretty much every human-built structure on Cayo Santiago was destroyed. It just raked over the island in a brutal way. And it was a real sort of effort, and it required kind of a coordinated effort, both, you know, in Puerto Rico and in the mainland United States, to keep them alive.
Yeah.
So at that point, early in October, data collection was on hold. And so that was my first experience there, just sort of seeing the monkeys. I actually wasn't allowed to go onto the island at that point. I didn't have the right sort of medical clearances that I needed to get. And it was hard to do anything in Puerto Rico at that time, shortly post-Maria. I went back there in February, and I went back actually, I think my second trip to the island was the second day of data collection, once they started kind of resuming, picking up, you know, the observational data and seeing what was going on and seeing how the monkeys had weathered the storm socially and psychologically and physically, and getting a sense of really the toll that the storm had taken, which wasn't immediately evident.
So you write in your piece that when researchers were able to start once again observing the monkeys, so that they saw very quickly that there were some marked changes in the macaque's behavior, right? I mean, you talked about, did you yourself see one macaque sort of sitting in a slightly sheltered area showing signs of what we would interpret as anxiety?
Yeah, well, there was, I think you're referencing the macaque that was sort of sitting under a bush,
yeah.
and making himself regurgitate repeatedly, and which was a behavior that, however you want to interpret it, it did, it seemed to spread from him to some other monkeys after the storm. There was another monkey that would sort of repeatedly kind of just sit and lick at a stone, at a pebble. In almost like a comforting way, perhaps. And there was, so there were these little sort of micro behaviors. And then there were larger changes in the kind of structure of the various troops that live on that island. There were a number of sort of alpha males that were deposed shortly after the island. And interestingly also, there was a pretty dramatic upsurge in the month following the storm of deaths among the monkeys, deaths that could not be attributed to starvation or, you know, lack of food or water, because of the efforts of the humans. Basically, the monkeys had enough to survive, but they were dying anyway. And the sort of upsurge pretty closely mirrored the sort of upsurge that you saw among the human population in Puerto Rico as well. These monkeys were dying post storm for mysterious reasons.
And there's still no definite theory from researchers about why we saw that spike?
Yeah, I'm sort of hesitant to to give a theory at this point, and there isn't any real consensus. But certainly there was, you know, there was a huge uptick in stress and, you know, anxiety. And there was, you know, there were increasingly limited resources, even though the humans were able to provide food. There was still the natural vegetation had been devastated. So the basic kind of lifestyle that they lived on the island had been pretty fundamentally altered.
Yeah, so we're going to talk more about the stress responses that that scientists have been observing in the macaques after Hurricane Maria. But did you also, I mean, did they also note some form social changes in the troops that showed a form of resilience after the storm?
Yeah, one of the most interesting kind of things to come out of the real sort of preliminary observational data that's coming off of Cayo is, or coming out of Cayo, is that despite these, despite the dire kind of straits that they were living in the wake of Maria, socially, they seem to actually post-storm be kind of widening their social networks and also fighting less. There seemed to be kind of less conflict among these survivors of this traumatic event. Now, this is sort of pretty good, solid observational data collected on Cayo Santiago. I can say that there's also lots of anecdotal data that the same thing happened in Puerto Rico among the human populations. I've talked to lots of people, among them the scientist in charge of Cayo Santiago, a woman named Angelina Ruiz Lambides, who will tell you that post-storm, despite the horrendous hardship that all Puerto Ricans were kind of enduring, they found that people tended to sort of pull together and that there was a sense of camaraderie and kind of common purpose that was lacking, you know, before the storm.
Hmm. Well, Luke Dietrich is a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. He's recently published a story in the magazine, a fascinating story called Primal Fear: Can Monkeys Help Unlock the Secrets of Trauma? We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point, and that is the sound of rhesus macaques on the island of Cayo Santiago off the coast of Puerto Rico. And like the main island of Puerto Rico, Cayo Santiago was devastated by Hurricane Maria, and the rhesus macaques there very quickly showed changes in their behavior, both individually and socially. And now the question is being asked about what the monkeys can teach us about the lasting effects of trauma and resilience. And we're talking today with Luke Dietrich. He is a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine, and he recently published a story about this exact issue titled Primal Fear: Can Monkeys Help Unlock the Secrets of Trauma? We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Have you experienced a natural disaster or a war or a famine? And how did it change you psychologically? How did the trauma last not only within you, if you felt a sense of trauma, but within your society at large? And what changes did you see, both negative and resilience, did you see as well? Now, Luke, I just have to ask you a quick question here that's really based off the title of your piece here, that can monkeys help unlock the secrets of trauma? Is that what researchers are thinking, that these macaques and how they've changed individually and at the level of their macaque society, that can give us insight into human societies and trauma?
It is certainly something that they have in mind, I would say, although researchers are always very quick not to overly anthropomorphize, you know, their subjects. But certainly monkeys do and always have provided an interesting window into ourselves, arguably. And, you know, in part because they are, the term researchers tend to use is they're less confounded than we are. They're less confounded by the sort of complications of human civilization. So, you know, the monkeys on Cayo Santiago all endured Hurricane Maria, for example, in more or less the same way. They weren't shielded by, you know, different types of houses and different economic resources and different this and different that. And so that, so when you're sort of drilling down to how Maria affected them, it may provide sort of clarifying insight into how Maria affects, or situations like Maria affect us.
Right. So tell us more specifically about, again, some of the behavior changes at the troop level that researchers have observed with these macaques. Because I think you write about how, for example, there was a break in the matrilineal sort of foundations of how the troops operated.
Sure. Well, that is there's one sort of anecdote where I was with a researcher named Lauren Brent, and we were following along with her research assistants some monkeys from Troop KK through this, you know, part of the shattered forest of Cayo Santiago, and one of her research assistants who had been on the island for actually longer than she had over the previous couple of months, mentioned that a particular female monkey from Troop KK had left Troop KK, basically eloped with a male, a high-ranking male from another troop, which struck Lauren as being curious, because monkey societies, macaque societies specifically, tend to be matrilineal. The female macaques stay in their natal troop usually, and it's the males that migrate outwards. So this was an unusual kind of female migration to another troop. Whether or not that had something to do with Hurricane Maria, I think, you know, I don't have the data to say whether or not that happened enough to be significant. But it certainly was something that you know, piqued her interest.
Right. So, Luke, hang on here for a second, because I want to turn now to Michael Platt. He's joining us from Philadelphia. He's director of the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton Neuroscience Initiative. He's been doing research on Cayo Santiago for over a decade, and his research focuses on structural changes in the brains of these macaques. Michael Platt, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us a little bit, first of all, about did Hurricane Maria change your research in any profound way before and after the hurricane devastated the island?
Yeah. So that's a great question. It sure did. We made a very hard pivot from trying to understand the basics of how the genes that monkeys are born with and their environment that they grow up in and how that translates into variation in their behavior. We moved very rapidly from that to trying to understand how all that variation in biology, in behavior and environment changes in response to something like Hurricane Maria, which is an intense acute stressor, but then is followed by chronic stress, as Luke has detailed so nicely. So all of us who, you know, there's quite a large group of us who are working on Cayo, have really seen, you know, the changes there, and we are working very hard to really try to understand how that's all happening.
I see. Now, as Luke said earlier, this is a very rare environment, right? Because you have such longitudinal data for 80 years on these monkeys, and I presume that you have samples of brain tissue from some of these monkeys from before Maria and now also after.
Right. So this is a unique opportunity because we have very detailed behavioral records going back decades. We have genetic data on this population, at least from our research, going back more than a decade. So DNA and gene sequence data on hundreds and hundreds of monkeys. And now as part of a population management program that was initiated before Hurricane Maria, we actually have brain samples from animals who were removed from Cayo the year before the hurricane and now 1 year after the hurricane. And so this is a very unique data set that will really allow us to begin to understand what happens to the brain at many different levels, from gene expression to structure of the brain, and how variation in these in the biology of these animals that they kind of come, you know, that they arrived at Maria with, how does that either help them to be resilient or vulnerable to mm-hmm. the stress induced by the hurricane?
So you say that it will help us understand, meaning that, because I was going to ask you, are you seeing structural changes already in any of the brains you've looked at?
So great question. We have not had an opportunity to look at the brains yet. So you can imagine that it was a heroic effort even to reinitiate the research. As Luke mentioned, almost every structure on the island was destroyed. And really, our efforts with the people on the ground in Puerto Rico and the staff were aimed at just kind of getting the animals taken care of first and the people taken care of, mm-hmm. and then to begin putting in place the structure that is necessary, the infrastructure to do the research. So we have collected the brains post Maria, and they are waiting to be processed, which will be done in a number of ways by a number of my colleagues.
Okay. Well, let's just go to the callers here if we can. Let's go to Nalisa, who's calling from Miami, Florida. Nalisa, you're on the air.
Hi there. I was curious to understand, historically, looking at gender, if they have changed in order to adapt to the natural disasters and the situation, and if all of the monkeys have become more communal as a result, are they working together more to combat this, or they become more isolated as a result?
Nalisa, thank you for your call. Michael Platt, do you have an answer for her?
Well, it's a great question. We have really taken a hard look at the data, especially over the past year. And what we are seeing is that there's something really interesting going on with the females. So females are kind of the center of each group. As Luke mentioned, these are matrilineal societies, so females tend to associate with their close kin, their daughters and sisters. And that preference is usually very strong, but we see that that preference actually kind of go away after the hurricane. So females are becoming much more tolerant of females from other families. And so they are somehow able to, work across those lines. And, you know, it's not that they cooperate together to sort of build structures or anything like that, but they are tolerating each other in a way that we haven't seen before.
Luke Dietrich, do you want to jump in here on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that maybe speaks to the event we were discussing earlier, where that one female macaque from Troop KK migrated into another nearby troop. Maybe it was something about this increased kind of tolerance that allowed that type of transition to take place, which otherwise would have been very rare.
Hmm. Let's go to Julie, who's calling from Moore, Oklahoma. Julie, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, here in Moore in the 2013 tornado, which devastated over 1,500 homes and over 24 people were killed. And our house was mostly fine, but so many of our neighbors and our community at large was just absolutely devastated to the ground. And I find it so fascinating because in times like that, you're always, told like to rise above it and to, band together, and these higher kind of parts of humanity that really show what people can do. And I find it so interesting that it's really more basic and more naturalistic than that. It's like reframing and tightening of communities through tragedy that even, monkeys mm-hmm. can do, and demonstrated through tragedy that completely reshapes their communities as well. And it's so indicative of humans as well.
Well, Julie, let me ask you, did you see there in Moore that sense of community and resilience and cooperation in the wake of those terrible tornadoes, did it last? How long did it last?
I feel like it lasts even now. Just this past week, schools were closed on Monday because of a heightened tornado threat, and people still, you band together, you think, well, we've done this before, we can do it again if we have to. You just kind of look to the people who were here before, and everyone just kind of, grits, if you make plans, and absolutely, the sense of community is still here. Some people think you're crazy, of course, but any given place, you know, has a threat level of something.
Well,
I found it so interesting, that monkey's characteristic of that as well.
Yeah, so. Julie, thank you so much for your call. Is that Luke? Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in because that post-tornado sense she's talking about reminds me of, I spent about a month in Joplin, Missouri after the tornado hit there. And I wrote a story about a group of people that survived the tornado in a gas station beer cooler, basically a walk-in beer cooler, about 20 of them. They were mostly all strangers. And what drew me to the story and what was really kind of remarkable about their experience was these strangers banded together in the absolute worst moments that they'd ever experienced. And one of the most moving things I've ever kind of gotten to report was how in their very last, what they thought might be their very last moments, as the tornado was literally ripping the walk-in beer cooler apart, they began shouting, "I love you, I love all of you," to each other out into this, you know, this swirling void. It's that type of kind of you know, fellowship during trauma that I think we may be seeing also on Cayo Santiago.
So, Michael Platt, I mean, that raises the obvious question of whether are these changes in the social structures of the macaque troops, are we still seeing them now, or have they lasted?
They have lasted. In fact, they have increased. And so we have seen a steady uptick in tolerance and in the kind of equitable distribution of social capital. So that's basically, you know, for a monkey, that's how many monkeys you tend to hang out with and spend time grooming and things like that. And what's kind of really remarkable, too, I mean, we've been talking about kind of the average response, mm-hmm. which is for monkeys to become more social as, you know, in response to the hurricane. But individual monkeys, just like individual people, actually differ in their kind of motivation and capacity to get along with others. And so we know that some monkeys have become much more social than others on average over the course of the over more than 1 year since the hurricane. And, you know, remarkably, it's those monkeys who before the hurricane who were the least anxious. So they showed the lowest signs of kind of self-directed behavior, scratching, pulling hair out, things like that. Who have now, in a sense, become the magnets for the other monkeys to kind of gather around. So these are the females in particular who have very strong social connections before the hurricane, and they're kind of gathering more in response to the hurricane.
So fascinating. So you're saying that, but there's this, it hasn't yet ebbed away. The monkey's behavior, as you said, spreading social capital or increasing social capital across the one troop or even across troops?
Well, typically we're looking at how this happens within groups. Many of these groups are – typically the groups live in different places on Cayo. And in fact, Cayo Santiago is made up of two islands with a small isthmus that connects them. And in fact, that isthmus was completely wiped out by the hurricane, leaving one group – more or less pretty isolated on that smaller island. So within these groups, though, we see within each of them this increasing tolerance, increasing equity in the distribution of kind of social relationships. We literally calculated the Gini index, which is used by economists to look at equitability and distribution of money within societies. And we're seeing essentially the equivalent for rhesus macaques. They're becoming more egalitarian.
Absolutely fascinating, right? Because this gets us into the whole world of, right, social biology, right? And the idea that the cooperative societies, human and animal, I don't know if we can say they thrive more, but it flies in the face of the idea that in the wake of a disaster, competition rises. We're seeing cooperation rise instead in the macaques.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable. We do know from studies in humans that having social connections, having strong social support is beneficial overall. So if you have more friends, more deeper connections with other people, you are going to be more likely to rebound after a traumatic event, as well as live a longer, healthier, happier life. I think there are important lessons here as well for us, in the sense that we're now seeing a real rise in the incidence of mental health disorders like anxiety and depression, especially amongst young people. And there's, you know, some data and certainly a lot of thought put into the idea that part of that might be the result of kind of the fraying of social connections when we spend so much of our time online, you know, isolated in our rooms. Then we actually, it's harder for us to actually, you know, recover after some kind of trauma.
Huh. Well, we are talking about the monkeys of Cayo Santiago. This group, or several hundred rhesus macaques, have been living there for 80 years, obviously before and after Hurricane Maria devastated the island, and what we're learning, what these monkeys can teach us about resilience and trauma. We'll be right back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the monkeys of Cayo Santiago. It is a tiny island off the coast of Puerto Rico. And like Puerto Rico itself, Cayo Santiago was devastated by Hurricane Maria in 2017. And there are groups of rhesus macaque monkeys that live on Cayo Santiago. And researchers have been taking a look at them for decades and now are asking, how do the macaques and their changes in their behavior and maybe even in their biology, what does that tell us about the long-term effects of mass trauma? I'm joined today by Luke Dietrich. He's a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. His recent story about this is titled Primal Fear: Can Monkeys Help Unlock the Secrets of Trauma? Michael Platt also joins us. He's director of the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton Neuroscience Initiative. He's been doing research on Cayo Santiago for over a decade. Now, let's just listen very briefly to a human voice of the human toll that Maria took on Puerto Rico. The CBC reported on what it called a quiet emergency of continuing mental health issues on Puerto Rico. And this past September, they spoke to a woman named Taina, who said she and her family still suffer from anxiety. And Taina described some of the scenes that continue to haunt her.
An old lady buried her husband in the back of her home because there was no way to get out of her home. He had been dead for 3 days and she had to bury him in the back of her home. When you hear these stories and you hear what people are going through, it weighs a toll on you.
Well, I want to introduce into the conversation now Athena Viscusi. She's joining us from New York. She's a psychosocial care specialist at Doctors Without Borders. Her work has taken her to the Democratic Republic of Congo, Central African Republic, Haiti, Liberia, Sierra Leone, South Sudan, amongst many other locations around the world. Athena Viscusi, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me on the show. This is a really interesting topic.
So tell us, first of all, what was your response, or what are your thoughts from reading both Luke's reporting and Michael Platt's research about how we see these effects of mass trauma, even on animals, on these rhesus macaques? How does that reflect on the work that you've done with people around the world?
Yeah, the discussion, there's been a lot of similarities. I guess I want to start with the good news that, you know, talking about this increased solidarity and cohesion in societies. I remember after the earthquake in Haiti, 6 months, a year later, people were kind of saying how they missed that neighbors had come out in the street to cook together for salvaging what they had, feeding the whole community, and how nice that had been. I think we see that in refugee situations often, where people arrive with nothing, but they're sharing everything, they're helping each other, redistributing goods to be more equitable. I liked what the caller was saying, that this, you know, that from the monkeys, we're thinking, well, this is instinctual to us. That's kind of good news, right?
Right?
It's not instinctual to us to turn on each other, but to turn towards each other. And then what Michael was saying about that we know that social support is probably the most important factor in preventing later post-traumatic stress symptoms after a disaster like this.
Well, so tell us more about that, because it's not just social support, but the immediacy of that social support in the in the wake of a disaster, right?
Right. So, you know, after a disaster, so Doctors Without Borders is known mostly for its medical care, but we increasingly provide mental health care, but also what we call psychosocial support, you know, not treating disease, but preventing and addressing the normal reactions that people have after a traumatic event. So first of all, people need their basic material needs met, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're starving, thirsty, cold, you know, hot, of course you're going to be symptomatic, you know. Then once those are addressed, then we often intervene with something we call psychosocial first aid, you know, which is basic, just human contact, reassurance, explaining some of the normal reactions, you know,
yeah.
and connecting people. Often you'll see Red Cross workers in a refugee camp trying to connect relatives who've been separated, right? After that's such a key intervention after a, you know, or an earthquake or a tsunami when people have had to scatter, reconnecting those connections. And then, you know, after psychological first aid, then we might have more intense psychosocial interventions that usually will be training local people to
right.
provide these interventions. If it is a community where there are, university-trained psychologists, counselors, then, of course, we'll be hiring those people. And Doctors Without Borders, 90% of our staff is always locally hired. It's a minimum of us that come from abroad. So, but if they're in the absence of professionals, we'll be training paraprofessionals because they, you know, they know their own mm-hmm. culture, their own community. So providing them with skills, you know, to recognize people who are in distress and then
yeah.
to help them. And also a lot of the social reconnection, you know, often we're doing a lot of music, drama, you know, art, things, anything that preserves the lost culture, you know, that can be really helpful. And then after that, then there are people who have, you know, serious distress.
Yeah.
And so we will be treating them with, you know, professional
right.
psychologists or psychiatrists, even using medication.
Well, so I just want to go back to our callers here because we have a lot of folks who have experienced something similar. So let's go to Allison, who's calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Allison, you're on the air.
Hi. In 1999, when Hurricane Floyd hit in our area, my son was 18 months old, and we had evacuated, but the rivers rose higher than we anticipated. And getting back home, my husband had to drive through water that scared a lot out of me. And it was very nerve-wracking to have an 18-month-old in the back seat wondering if we were going to be swept away. So we have changed a lot of behaviors. We keep a supply kit in the back of the car in case we're ever someplace we need to stop and rest before we go further. We change the way we evacuate.
Mm-hmm.
We look where the rivers cross the roads. And I went so far as to become a disaster preparedness professional and brought what I learned from my personal experiences into my workflow.
Yeah. Well, Allison, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Enrique, who's calling from Miami, Florida. Enrique, you're on the air.
Hello there. What a great subject. I mean, especially for us to live in South Florida. I've been here for almost 30 years, so I've had more than one encounter for sure, more than a couple of hurricanes passing by. And there's a couple of things that I see that are very interesting. One of them is obviously the anxiety that we see in here. Most of the time, it's prior to the storm, seems to so much massive media approach for everybody to get ready, for everybody to do everything we do. Unfortunately, a lot of people here, in the last 10 years, before Maria, before the hurricanes that we had last year, it had been 10 years that we never had a storm. So a lot of the people that were living here, they had never experienced a storm
yeah.
before. And you will see people freaking out left and right and going like crazy on a supermarket. I saw a lady with more than 20 loaves of bread. She got all the bread that was on the shelf, all the bread, and fighting for the last one because she needed all of it,
uh-huh.
you know? So I wonder if that kind of behavior you see on monkeys, if you've seen more than one storm that you've been following on the island. The other thing that I see, it's afterwards, it's not much because, you know, after 7-10 days, everything gets back to normal.
Right.
But really, what we see here is that prior to the storm, since there's so much pressure from all the government agencies and everybody else, it's just people go crazy,
right.
before a storm comes.
Enrique, you've asked a really interesting question. I want to turn. Thank you so much for your call. I want to turn it to Michael Platt. Any increase in selfish behaviors, Michael?
That's a great question. We haven't looked at aggression yet. That is something that we aim to dig into. But you know, it is really interesting that we are seeing, in general, greater tolerance. So monkeys, Rhesus macaques in particular, are the most despotic non-human primate species. So they are, although they can cooperate, they are fiercely competitive with each other, and they. Most of what they compete over is trying to be high status. So that sounds very familiar to us. And high status confers certain benefits in terms of access to resources, food, shelter, and other individuals as well. And so the fact that we are seeing this, you know, at minimum kind of tolerance of others that you wouldn't normally tolerate, that you would chase away, I think is really suggestive that they really dialed down you know, the aggression and kind of dialed up the tolerance.
Mm. Luke Dietrich, let me turn back to you here for a moment because, you know, we've, of course, been focusing on the monkeys, on the macaques for this hour. But, I mean, in the course of your reporting, you also talked quite in depth with people who, you know, the researchers who are working with these monkeys, the Puerto Ricans who are there year round, caring for them, going back and forth between Cayo Santiago and Puerto Rico. I'm thinking about Daniel Phillips, who you opened your story with. They too lived through this massive storm. I mean, how's Daniel doing? Are they feeling the lingering effects of the trauma they experienced?
Right. And that was really what drew me to this story. I mean, Cayo Santiago is a fascinating place and the work that's being done there is remarkable. But really what appealed to me about this story was that it was a chance to kind of explore, you know, where the rubber meets the road in scientific research in this one particular case where you have a bunch of people like Daniel Phillips, who is a research assistant who goes out to Cayo Santiago, you know, multiple times a week and observes the monkeys and is gleaning information that may be useful to us in understanding how we, you know, process trauma. And he himself went through this absolutely traumatizing event. His father had dementia. He has a young brother. It was just the three of them. They were worried that their house was going to, you know, basically slide down a hill. They were isolated for about 5 days, I think. Nobody at Cayo Santiago or nobody at the Caribbean Primate Research Center had heard from him because there was no cell service or anything like that. He had to immediately post-storm, you know, walk 4 miles to get a chainsaw to just begin clearing the road. He was in the thick of this mammoth disaster that was Maria. But then as soon as he could, he began going back to Cayo Santiago and doing his job, which is to collect data on these monkeys. And so I found this kind of, you know, this mirror effect fascinating. These people who were themselves traumatizing, conducting this seminal research that may indeed help us understand how trauma works and what it does to us.
So Athena Viscusi, this is all leading me to wonder, I mean, we're discussing here that we're seeing in monkeys a very profound social biological response to, you know, a mass trauma event like a natural disaster. And then, you know, I heard you say very clearly that there's a lot of evidence that if we don't deal with psychological trauma quickly after a disaster, the effects are long term in humans and now possibly also even in animals. Knowing that, though, I mean, shouldn't we perhaps be doing more prior to an event like a hurricane to set up our societies? To be prepared to deal with that social psychological trauma immediately. Is there more that we can do beforehand?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and I think that's the idea of training people in psychological first aid. You know, so that paraprofessionals can respond with these skills. I love the story of the woman who called in, who's become a disaster preparedness professional herself after experiencing that. You know. It's a little bit like this person in the journalist was talking about, who's taking care of the monkeys but also repairing his own life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we see that so much, that if you've experienced it yourself, you can be a better helper, even if you're not a professional in that area. It reminds me, in Liberia, we trained survivors of Ebola to be patient care, paraprofessionals, because they could say, I lived through it. You can too, you know.
Yeah.
And they had the passion for the work. But sure, and that's what we've seen in Doctors Without Borders, that more and more we need to think about the psychosocial needs and incorporate them right away in our response, not after we've built the hospital, but right away. It also reduces the work of the doctors, because a lot of the people come, with headaches, stomach ache, pains that are really, anxiety, that
uh-huh.
that are from their, their emotional state that they're somaticizing.
Yeah.
And they're much more appropriately done with, counseling is more appropriate than Advil.
Right.
But the other thing is I think there's some, and I'm not a researcher, but thinking of the first responders after 9/11, thinking of refugees that I've seen in camps.
Mm-hmm.
So this initial, and I don't know if this is what's happening in Puerto Rico, right after the disaster, there's a response. There's services, and then after time, those services leave.
Right.
And often we have seen actually a rise in symptoms like a year later, of a small minority, not of the population in general. And in all these disasters, usually 75% of the population has no symptoms like after 3 months. But we do see, and I think it's from, that as long as there's services, people caring, people talking, people mm-hmm. bringing you blankets and clean water, has a protective factor. And then when those things disappear, then some of the pathologies get worse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Athena Viscusi, psychosocial care specialist at Doctors Without Borders, joining us from New York today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Michael Platt, director of the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton Neuroscience Initiative, been doing research on Cayo Santiago for more than a decade. Thank you so much for being with us. Looking forward to seeing what your research continues to show us over the next several years.
Well, thank you, too. It's been great to be here.
And Luke Dietrich, contributing writer at the New York Times and author of New York Times Magazine and author of the recent story in the magazine titled Primal Fear: Can Monkeys Help Unlock the Secrets of Trauma? Luke, thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.